This is Listening to the Dead.
Uncovering the secrets of forensics today.
I'm Linda LaPlante, novelist, producer, writer of 150 hours of TV and 33 crime novels. And truthfully, I don't think one could have been completed without the assistance of the police, especially my close friend Cass Sutherland.
Hi, I'm Cass Sutherland, former detective and CSI in the Metropolitan Police Force.
This is Episode 6, Pathology.
Now, this is a subject we both feel we know well. I've attended countless crime scenes and postmortems as part of my duties as a CSI. But I believe you've been to a postmortem yourself as part of your research work.
The very first autopsy I went to, this detective, she said to me, have you ever been to an autopsy? I said, oh, yes. Hadn't ever been to an autopsy. Of course I haven't. And she said, oh, good, because you're going to one this morning. I said, okay, fine. And I arrived there, and I am quite short, very small person. And there was a green gown that must have been made for somebody about 6 foot, and a hat that was too large. And I'm standing there, and then he said, have you got Wellington boots? I said, pardon? Put your wellies on, darling. And they were very large size of white boots, so I got into these. I mean, I did look like a Smurf. And they said, all right, we're in room two. So I toddle on room two, and I'm following other people in green coats and white wellies and masks. And in we go. And she has disappeared, my friend. And pathologists, you see, characters. He was there lowering the microphone. And he goes, who's this? Who's this? This little person here? And somebody said, she's a writer. Oh, well, come forward, dear, come forward. So I'm now in front of the table. I have never seen a dead body. And this was an enormous one with a big green sheet over it. And I'm standing there, and there was a very large tray of instruments that were wheeled beside the pathologist. He begins using the microphone, and he's got a clipboard. So then he throws the sheet off, and I really have never known anything so horrendous as when he made the incision. Nobody ever warned me that, you know, you often get a very large fart sound of gases. Nobody had warned me about the smell. I went down like a light balloon, absolutely crashed into the trolley and was carried out. I think apparently I left a welly boot, but I have never ever forgotten that moment of horror. And I have been in numerous ones since and held on because I felt that I should know more. But, I mean, the joke was put Vic up your nose so that the smell clears. You don't have the stench. That is a lie. No, it isn't. What Vic does is clear your airways and you get an even stronger sense of the smell. You know, and I wrote that down in one of the shows with Jane Tennyson.
Actually, I remember my first postmortem as probationers. You were all taken to watch just a natural postmortem. It wasn't a murder. It was just a normal death, an elderly lady at Hackney Mortuary. And what happened was I saw her and that, and it was explained to us by the pathologist. And a few days later, I was in the television room in the section house, and I was just sitting there, put the telly on to see what was on, and it was Songs of Praise. And it was at this church in Hackney. And there was this little old lady. And I thought, that can't be right. I've seen her. She's dead. And, of course, what it was, I'd totally forgotten that it's pre-recorded. So it wasn't. but my knees started to go. And I thought, no, this was made before, sadly, before she died. But that was my first post-mortem.
Yeah, but you know, on a really kind of more serious note, I have been to many more since, and I can hold my own now. But the pathologist is probably the most recognised forensic science. They have been portrayed in so many films and books that it's almost a cliché to have them chatting with detectives and being asked for time of death about 2 minutes after they arrived.
Yeah.
And you actually do see over and over again in earlier kind of Agatha Christie's, is what time do they die? I'd say between 5 and 5.15. There is no possible way that they can come up with that 5 to 5.15. In fact, one pathologist once said to me, you know, the only way you can get an exact time of death is if the assailant has smashed the victim's watch. Then you got it. They died at 6.25. Bingo.
Of course, as we both know, there's many variables for time of death, but the main role of the pathologist is to give us the cause of death. As a former CSI, I worked alongside many pathologists during my career, but I've actually been out of the game for a good few years now, so I was thrilled when I got a chance to speak to Dr. Stuart Hamilton. He's a forensic pathologist at the East Midlands Forensic Pathology Unit. I'm here in my office about to call Dr. Stuart Hamilton. He's performed over 3,000 autopsies, ranging from sudden and unexpected deaths to complex multiple homicides. With such extensive experience, he'll have a wealth of knowledge about forensic medicine and all the information a dead body can provide. He is very directly listening to the dead. Let's give him a call. I must apologise to any listeners who can hear a few bumps and thuds. It's not anybody dealing with any dead bodies. It's just some builders who happen to be next door, unfortunately.
Hello.
Hello, Stuart. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Fine, thank you. I'm sure our listeners would love to know, firstly, how did you get into forensic pathology and what exactly does your job entail?
As all forensic pathologists, I initially trained as a doctor, working on the wards. I realised that that wasn't really my forte, and so I moved more towards the lab-based bits of medicine, so general pathology, and I was just naturally drawn to the intersection between medicine and the law and police investigation, and so I ended up as a forensic pathologist. Which means my day job is pretty much if somebody dies in suspicious circumstances, whatever they may be, then the police call me and I perform the post-mortem examination of the body and try to identify why they're dead and if that's somebody else's fault.
Do you find, I found from my experience as a CSI, actually attended more question marks, suspicious, unexplained deaths than actual murder scenes. Do you find that's still the case?
Yes, that's very much the case. The whole way that our system is set up is that you expect one case that you're called to in three to be a true homicide. The other two are going to be suspicious deaths, so there are question marks about them, but not clear-cut murders. And actually, I find those ones far more interesting.
If, for example, if we have a murder scene, somebody's dead inside a flat or a house, the police call you and you get there, what sort of processes or steps do you take and what do you do at the scene?
The scene in the modern era is very much allowing me to see a body in context. So when you have somebody in the mortuary just on a generic table, yes, you can see the body, but you can't see what's going on around it. And while in the past, sort of 50, 100 years ago, the pathologist would come in, they'd interpret the blood patterns, they'd look at the scene, they'd look at all the things around the body. These days, we're very keen to say, I deal with the body, but the reason we have crime scene managers, forensic biologists, blood spatter experts, is because they can then bring their expertise to the scene. So in the modern day, it's very much more about what can I get out of seeing the body in context rather than necessarily adding a lot to the investigation at that point. The post-mortem examination, so the actual physical examination of the body, is very much about the detail of the injuries that the person has, about any disease they might have that would cause or contribute to their death. So that's very much more detail with relation to the body itself, rather than that overview of what's the context. So they are distinct and slightly different approaches to the body, but together they can produce very powerful evidence.
Do you find you use different types of light sourcing prior to doing the post-mortem on the body to bring up injuries or footwear marks on bodies that the human eye can't see in normal conditions?
Yes, alternative light source photography, as it's called, can be very useful. You can use high contrast, you can use ultraviolet, and that can sometimes really bring out particularly patterned injuries. As a pathologist, we are very interested in patterned injuries because a pattern, like a footwear mark, can be then associated with a shoe, that can be associated with a person, that can be very, very important.
At the scene, obviously, if you're called yourself, the body may have been there for a few days. There's flies, maggots. There's other experts that obviously can contribute. Do you like to work with them there or certainly have speak to them during the investigation?
I think it's cases that are complex like that are very collaborative. There are a lot of areas of expertise that you can sit down together and build the picture. So I'll be bringing things from what I can see, the entomologists dealing with the insects, the blood pattern people particularly will be bringing their expertise along, and together we can build a much better picture talking to each other than you would if you were working individually.
Of course, one of the things that the police are always sort of after pathologists for and want answers on is time of death. I remember a pathologist saying to me once, well, it's from the time someone last saw them to the time you found them.
Yes.
Because there wasn't enough information. I just wondered if you sort of concurred with that. And are there scientific advancements to help towards that, the time of death?
Yes. This is one of the things that is mildly interesting in our career, that when I started training, which would be 20 or so years ago, we would take core body temperatures, we'd assess rigor mortis, and we'd give an opinion on time of death based on those physical factors. Actually, as research has gone on, we've realised that we can't narrow it down, that actually the variables are so many that it broadens out to the point where what you've just said about from when they were last seen alive to when they're found dead is probably the best a pathologist can actually say. I've certainly said that in courts before, but there are other technological advances which I think narrow things down much better. We can argue the merits of the degree of closed circuit television coverage there is in the UK, but certainly if somebody's walking along the street, timestamped 7 o'clock in the evening, they weren't dead then. And mobile communications, cell site analysis, so a lot of that other information that's constantly being created by a person living in the modern world will often be far more useful than me and a thermometer.
Yes, because as you know, in days gone by, certainly in the sort of 70s and that era, there were times of death that were given, and the defendant would have an alibi for that time, and they would be your strongest suspect, and of course the cases would collapse because those things were incorrect. So
yes,
it's good that it's open. From my personal point of view, I was always a great believer in, like with unexplained deaths, if you think murder till the investigation proves otherwise,
yes,
you shouldn't go wrong. Have you had many cases where a body's come into the mortuary and it's classed as a non-suspicious death, then you've found, you've gone, whoa, hang on here, there's something not right?
At least twice a year we'll get something like that. It is uncommon, but it is entirely dependent on the opinion and the experience of the first person going to that body.
Yes, that's exactly what I was just going to say. From my experience, I've had where, for example, a guy, he was collapsed just nearby his flat, and they just thought he was known locally, and the first officer said, oh, that's Joe the drunk.
Yes.
And they thought it was hypothermia, and everybody just thought, oh, it's Joe the drunk, and it went on. And actually, if they'd stepped back and taken their time to look at where his glasses were, some of the injuries on him, you know, it was a case where he said, well, actually, I think we need a pathologist here because there's something not quite right. And of course, the thing is, if that's not done correctly at the time, the amount of evidence that can be lost, moving the body or doing certain things, could that affect your conclusions?
Yes. Once a body is moved, then obviously there's potentially contamination. Thinking a long way down the line, if it goes to court and you've got a piece of evidence, say trace evidence or DNA, then that's going to be far more questioned if you've had 15 people tramping through that scene than three scenes of crime officers, a forensic scientist and a pathologist in appropriate protective equipment. So it can grotesquely interfere with that. And from a criminal investigation point of view, if it takes you a week to identify that this is a homicide, then that's a week for the perpetrator to get his story straight, to potentially get out of the country, to wash his clothes, to destroy things, to get rid of things. So it can have an enormous impact on how much information can be produced, and it can ultimately lead to prosecutions failing or not being brought at all.
In respect of the body, if it's treated as non-suspicious, go to the mortuary, it may not be till some hours later or the next day that a routine post-mortem is started on it. Could that movement affect hypostasis? And could you tell our listeners what hypostasis is?
Yes, hypostasis is the pooling of blood after death in the body. So once the heart stops, with gravity, then the blood will tend to gravitate to the lowest point. So if you've got somebody lying on their front as opposed to lying on their back, you will get a different pattern. Yes, that can be lost, which can be very helpful if you want to know what position somebody may have been in or how long they've been in that position. Unfortunately, not to get on my high horse about this, but the funding available and the importance of autopsy pathology in this country at the moment is such that you're potentially looking sometimes at several days to a week before any pathologist actually views that body. So that in itself can interfere with a lot of things.
Can you give us some idea of how many scenes you might attend in a month, 6 months, a year?
Yes. So I cover the on-call, which means I'm available as and when the police want me, 1 week in three. And we average 5 to 6 cases for each of those weeks. So you're talking in excess of 50 in a year. And that is only the suspicious deaths. So that is the tip of the iceberg of the amount of autopsies that need doing or deaths that need investigating. It's an awful lot of work. It's forensic pathology is relatively well staffed, but general pathology autopsy practice is very understaffed, and it can create problems for obvious reasons.
Do you get much free time?
Not as much as I'd like. It's not just doing the autopsy. That's almost the easy part. It's writing the report. It's forming your conclusions. It's standing up in court and explaining that to a jury who probably know next to nothing about the detail of what we're talking about. It is very time consuming.
Technology's moved on as well. When you mentioned court, when I was a detective in CSI, at court they would show the crime scene pictures, you know, of the victims. and cases where, you know, the defence had blown them up and they'd hold them up. And of course, you've got families sitting in court. But now things have moved on and it's 3D imagery and that is used. Do you find that you can put your findings over better with 3D imagery?
I think it makes it a lot more neutral and a lot less visceral in both a literal and metaphorical sense. So I think it is useful for the juries to take the emotional aspect of pictures of a genuine dead body, potential murder victim, out of it. I think sometimes the images can be so sanitized that they don't really reflect what's happened to the person. But I do think they're much more practical than a big booklet of photographs of somebody in various states of being cut open.
People assume that pathologists just deal with the dead. From my own experience, a case I had where a young girl had been raped and she was in a coma and strangled and was found. And they wanted to let, at first it said, oh, let the doctor at the hospital can examine her and give the evidence. But my view was, no, you need a pathologist to do that, because the amount of information that a pathologist can give you, and they also have the experience of giving that evidence in court. Do you agree with that?
It's something I do quite regularly, actually, both for prosecution and defence. And you're quite right. We bring the experience of interpreting those injuries in the context of a criminal investigation that clinical doctors simply don't have. That is not a criticism of them.
Yeah.
If my wife tomorrow crashes her car, I want an orthopedic surgeon to fix her leg. I want a neurosurgeon to fix her head injury. I want an expert in intensive care to make sure that she comes out as well as she can. I wouldn't want a forensic pathologist to do those roles because they'd be awful at it. But when it comes to interpreting how those injuries occurred, that is what I do. And I know the rules of giving evidence on that in court.
When I was serving, the National Injuries Database existed and still does. Have you ever actually used that much? And could you explain to the listener what that is?
So the National Injuries Database is a central repository of lots and lots and lots and lots of cases that have gone through that can be searched, so that if somebody has an unusual injury, something you've not seen before, the idea is that you can go to a central place, it can be searched and go, well, actually, we've got three cases that are similar to that, and they were the result of this sort of assault. So it is a resource that's there that we can use, and it sometimes pulls up some very interesting findings. I remember upsetting a lot of people in B&Q one day, when I had an odd injury, and I really wasn't sure what the implement was that had caused it. And as I was about to try and buy some shelves for my garage, I looked up at the masonry hammers and went, that's what killed him! Which gave people a bit of a shock, really.
What would you say are some of your most memorable cases?
I've got a few that have been quite interesting. I dealt with the murder of the Witcherleys up in Nottinghamshire, who'd been buried in their garden for the better part of 20 years. Very strange story, but we managed to recover them. Largely skeletal remains, but where we were able to recover bullets from those bodies, or what was left of them, to confirm that they would have been lethal injuries given the location of the bullets. And it was a very good investigation. It was very collaborative. We had the anthropologist confirming that sort of the age, the race, the sex of the bodies, the skeletal remains. We had the ballistics experts looking at the caliber of the weapon, which was unusual. We had the pathologist talking about the different sorts of locations of injury and why that would have killed somebody. And despite the fact it was the better part of 20 years since the actual murders, we were able to get convictions on that.
How long does the average post-mortem, forensic post-mortem last?
So a forensic post-mortem will usually take about 2 hours if it's relatively straightforward. Clearly, if there are many, many injuries, it will take much longer. Although, perversely, it will take much longer, but you end up pointing out the obvious. I distinctly recall dealing with a man who had 24 hammer marks to his head and 63 stab wounds to his neck. And after about 6 or 7 hours of working through that, I turned to the police officer in the case and said, I think he's died because he was hit on the head with a hammer and stabbed in the neck. And you could see the look on his face of, it's taken you 6 hours and 20 years of medical experience to tell me that.
Similarly, though, I have known, and I haven't known a police officer to ask, but any idea of a cause of death, I think the knife sticking out of his chest might be a clue. So.
It often gives you a hint, yeah, as to what might be happening there.
It's interesting, Chip. We've never actually met until today over this Skype conversation, but we do have something in common in that we both advise on silent witness. I just wonder what your opinion is on how fiction reflects on reality.
Invariably, drama always prefers a murderer and a victim and an answer. I think that it's a good drama and it gets the science right, but it does truncate the timescales, because if I have to wait 8 weeks for a neuropathology result, that does not make for fascinating
TV. Or toxicology that normally takes a few weeks just turn around in minutes. Yeah.
Absolutely. DNA results take quite a while to get back. So, you know, I take the view that get the science right, but tell a story that people want to watch. A documentary of me spending 7 hours over somebody who's been stabbed is not fascinating viewing.
Actually, I think it would be, Stuart. in fact, you did have a cameo role, I believe, in one of the shows, didn't you?
I was a photographer in one of the episodes about 5 years ago, and I have been told off many times by my CSI colleagues for not having the camera strap around my neck.
Funny, I was given a cameo in a Lyndall Plants Above Suspicion TV shows. I said 4 words and was shot, and that was my part.
I didn't even get a speaking part. I got pointed at by Amelia Fox.
You know why they don't work? Because you get paid more if you speak, you see, in TV shows. You could claim more, that's why.
Oh, well, I've definitely got a face for radio.
Stuart, thank you so much for your time. It's been really interesting hearing about your work and what you do. And I think the great thing is that each of the different forensic experts I've spoken to is how much all their work interweaves with each other, and it's not just about one discipline. It's about working together to get the best results.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more.
Thanks very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
I'm so glad we saved pathology until the end of this series, as it really ties everything together. We got this sense of the interplay between the forensic science. Stuart talking about how he used to read the blood patterns, but that's now someone else's job and he just focuses on the body.
Yes, it's amazing how all the different forensic sciences and disciplines we've looked at actually kind of like intertwine and interween with each other. But communication between them and the detectives is imperative to my mind. And that's the way that the quest to find the criminal will work. When you're working together, communicating. In years gone by, the sort of 60s, 70s, 80s, and I'd say maybe even a little bit of the 90s, pathologists were seen as gods, and they were considered omnicompetent. You know, that whatever they said about the crime scene, whatever they said about the body, that was right, and nobody would challenge that. And they didn't challenge themselves. But I think now it's moved on, and you know, they challenge their own theories. They look at the evidence. They look at other evidence that might come in. They also, you know, they're made aware of, well, what did the defendant say or the suspect say in interview. And then you give that statement, you know, to the pathologist or whatever, and the pathologist can say, well, no, that simply couldn't have happened. Whereas it's an ongoing process. The pathologist, not just the scene, not just the body, thank you, goodbye. He needs to be kept up to date throughout the inquiry once you arrest somebody and in relation to what they say to say whether it's true or not.
I was also interested to hear Stuart say that only one in three of the cases he's called to is a homicide. The others are suspicious or unexplained deaths.
Yes, I would agree with that. I often found that to be the case myself during my career. But always think murder till the investigation proves otherwise.
You know, Cass, that's your catchphrase. Yes.
Well, that's it for this episode.
Yes, and this was supposed to be our last episode, but as luck would have it, we've an old friend dropping by next week to record a special bonus episode on fibre analysis.
Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnier Books. Our producer is Chris Attaway. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening now, and a new episode will pop up in your feed every week. Until then, thanks for listening.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Listening to the Dead. My new novel, Buried, is out April 2nd, 2020, in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.